Hello, and welcome to the Rooted in Reliability podcast, your plant performance podcast, where we dive deeper into asset management techniques and know-how. I'm your host, James Kovacevic, and I will be your guide to achieving industry best practice. The Rooted in Reliability podcast is here to provide you with the insights to improve plant performance and deliver bottom-line results to your organization. In case you missed the last episode, you can find the Rooted in Reliability podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, and on the reliability.fm network. Don't forget to subscribe so you'll never miss an episode. Now let's dive into today's topic. It is my pleasure to welcome Peter Hosbro to the podcast. Welcome, Peter.
Oh, g'day, James. How you going, mate?
I'm doing well, Peter. And I apologize if I butchered your last name. So I may just refer to you as your nickname, Seven, for the rest of this podcast to avoid that again.
You know, that'll be fine. Absolutely fine, mate.
All right. So, Peter, you are an engineer, a manager, and a leader with a passion for machine reliability.
Yes.
You've been a maintenance and reliability engineer for over 20 years, working in mining, smelting, power gen, and across a few different organizations. You're also a speaker, an author of the book we're going to talk about, The 5 Habits of an Extraordinary Reliability Engineer.
Yes.
And you also are the founder of ReliabilityExtranet.com.
That's correct.
What did I miss there in your brief summary that you may want to fill in?
From a reliability point of view, I think you've pretty well hit it on nail on the head. I'm also a pilot. I've been flying aeroplanes since I was about 15 years old and could actually fly an aeroplane by myself before I could actually drive a car by myself here in Australia. So it's something that something a little extra. And the aeroplane theme is actually going to start turning up in Reliability Extranet in the near future.
Excellent. And, you know, reliability is pretty important when you're a pilot because you can't just pull over and call a tow truck.
Yes, so. Correct. Yes. And there's hence some of the things that we do flying aeroplanes is going to be suggested. And we'll talk about habit 3 a little bit later. But that's one of my passions is flying, and I'm going to actually do a little video on practicing when the pressure is off, just to let the cat out of the bag on something, to demonstrate what you can do from a reliability point of view as well. So practice when the pressure is off.
Excellent. You can make mistakes then. There's not as large a consequences when the pressure's off. There's a lot of advantages, I think, to that. So I'm excited to see that insight.
Yeah, no problem.
Now, recently you wrote a book titled The 5 Habits of an Extraordinary Reliability Engineer. Yes. You happened to send me a copy of it, and I must say it is not your typical maintenance reliability book. And what I mean by that is it was easy to read, and it was very logical, and it made sense.
Right. Thank you. Yep.
Now, some of these books, they get very in-depth, very technical. Yeah. And while that is required at certain points, it's nice to have a simple, logical, straightforward, easy-to-read book on this topic. So that's what I want to talk about today, is that book.
Yep.
No problem. What prompted you to write this book?
Well, like what you just said, I wanted to write something. So if I could use the analogy, you mentioned that essentially I've been a reliability engineer for about 20 years, and that's approximately right. I wanted something out there that if it took 3 months for someone to read my book, I wanted something out there that would move them 19 years and 7 months ahead of where I am by reading it. And I wanted also something a little different. So I'm really, really happy that you mentioned that, you know, the book is different to other reliability engineers' book. And that was by intent. And I didn't want a technical book. I wanted a book that basically distilled what I'd learned over the years, and the habits are things that I've learned where I won't waste time on doing things that won't add value to what I'm trying to do from a reliability point of view. So if you apply the 5 habits, you'll have confidence that you are not necessarily, you are not wasting your time on the wrong things, essentially, is where I was trying to go. And I was also trying to obviously avoid the technical thing, but and start talking about the soft side, what I call the soft side of reliability. Okay, so there's the hard side, which is all the technical stuff and, you know, RCM and blah, 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 blah. Whereas there's the soft side, and the soft side is working with people, essentially. And, you know, that's definitely in habit five. So I was, that's the intent of the book is you know, to distill some knowledge and have something a little different out there. Essentially you've got it there.
Excellent. Now, I know that you mentioned the soft stuff. That's the people skills, the change mm-hmm. management stuff. Mm-hmm. And what I typically find is that is the hardest part for most of mm-hmm. us engineers or maintenance guys to get through.
Yes.
That's not what we do. We're not experts at marketing and communication and all mm-hmm. those other things you need to do, which is the soft stuff. But that makes one of the biggest differences in being successful with maintenance reliability improvements. Would you agree?
I totally agree. And, you know, habit 1, 2, 3, and 4 are basically designed so that you spend most of your time on habit 5, working with the people, because that's where you actually extract the value.
Yes, absolutely. I couldn't agree more. More than often, I get asked to help with certain projects, certain improvements, and the vast majority of time, the people on the floor already know what they need to do. Mm-hmm. You just need to go talk to them.
Yeah. And getting it to happen and changing people's beliefs and mindsets around things, you know, it's been quite often where, actually a story. I've had, there's a reliability improvement initiative that I was working on, and I was actually issued a trade, we call them tradesmen down here in Australia, but craftsmen is the American equivalent. I was issued a craftsman to help me implement some changes. And this guy came to me and said, I don't believe we're going to make a change. Literally, he came to me and said, I don't believe we're going to make a change with what you're suggesting, Seven. And I said, well, I just sort of pulled rank a little bit. I'm the engineer here, mate. You're going to have to trust me on this and just do as I say. Can you do that? And he said, yes, I can. And I said, all right, this is what we're going to do. And so we started working on things, and, you know, and it wasn't until he actually detected some physical differences whilst we're doing something on a gearbox. I don't know if we've got time for the story, but the story was that we're doing some changes and improving the oil condition on this particular site. This is one of the stories in the book, actually. And what had happened was we got a particularly bad oil sample, and I myself and him went out to have a look at this gearbox, and it was running at the time, and it sounded really, really bad. Like, you know, you walk up to it and you go, ooh. Oh, this is not good. This is not good. And they were using it for production at the time. And I said to mate, get on the radio. We call it the blower. Get on the radio, and call this thing out. Tell them to swap to the other side. So we tried to do that, and production said, no, we can't swap to the other side. And so I said, well, you can hear this. And he said, yes. And I said, well, we've got to do something about it. What can we do? Threw it out there as I normally do, and sort of taking a leaf from what you just said there, mate, is, you know, ask the production people what they think they can do. And he says, well, we need to get the oil out of that thing. And I said, well, how do we get the oil out of that thing whilst it's online? And he said, well, how about we stick some oil through the top, and we'll drain it out at the same time. And I said, I was going to suggest that too. So that's what we did. And he says, oh, we're going to waste a lot of oil doing that. And I said, well, if we blow this gearbox at this point in time, I think we'll burn more money than say, 1,000 litres of oil. And he said, you're right. And I said, you reckon you can do it? And he says, yeah. I think we've got the equipment to do it. And he says, yeah. I said, well, let's do it. Okay. If the boss comes and sees me about the price of the oil, that's my problem. He says, yep. Okay, Seven, let's do it. So he did. And you know, he threw essentially 1,000 litres of oil in this thing whilst it was running. And, you know, the most important part of it was that the oil level was kept at the correct level. So, you know, he didn't drain too much out of it whilst he's putting it in. And lo and behold, after 200 litres as Gordon threw this gearbox, he rings me up on my cell phone, rings me up and says, hey, Seven, it's changed sound. And I said, awesome. And he says, it actually sounds better. It actually, this is going well. From that point on, I had him. Everything that I did, he started asking questions. Oh, why are we doing this? And, you know, what difference is this going to make? And you know, we move forward in leaps and bounds from there.
Yeah, you brought him along on that journey. You made him excited and all those great things.
Yes. And then the irony of the whole thing is, you know, where we started from to where we ended. I ended up leaving the organization and he ended up leaving the organization too. And he applied for another job and he rang me and said, oh, Seven, can you give me a reference? And I said, yeah, sure. And he says, got to make sure about that oil stuff. You got to tell him about that oil stuff. And I said, no problem, mate.
Excellent.
Yeah.
So I'm sure over the course of that story and many of these other stories that you have, you came up with these five habits. Is that exactly how you came up with them? Or did you sit down one day and said, okay, here's the five things that we need to do as reliability engineers?
Ah, there's another story there. where to start? The way that I came up with the five habits is very interesting. And it was part of a business course that I actually did down here and in Australia. And they actually provided me a book coach to help me write the book and provide the resources to get the book out. But cut a long story short, and you probably can tell I can tell stories. in this course, they actually sat down and forced us to think of all of the issues that we've had in our careers. So my career being a reliability engineer and I had to think about 100 as a minimum, okay? So I can remember doing this particular exercise. So I've got children and my daughter was auditioning for a drama production. And I had to do this particular exercise for this training course. It was due, blah, 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 blah. So I actually sat down outside my daughter's drama auditions with my computer sitting on this bench it was autumn in Australia. It was quite a nice period. I remember it. And I sat down and thought of over 100 issues that I had in my career. And then the exercise was group the common ones. So I grouped the common ones together and lo and behold, there was a pattern that I recognized. And that's where I came up with what's called the five don'ts. Okay, so that's how we led the book was with the five don'ts, the five things that I didn't do to lead to the problems. And this is where, you know, you noticed I used the word I, and it's all about me. And this is where the habits come from. So I didn't understand something. I didn't question something. I didn't use data to make a decision and I didn't facilitate the implementation. Okay. So that's where the five don'ts come up. And so that's from that 100 problems. So the five habits on the opposite side of that. And this is where the stories start coming from in the book. And I had to sit down and think about right, where I got it right, where I got it wrong, where I got it right, what did I do? Well, I'd identified the issue. I understood what was going on. I questioned someone about what they were actually doing. I used data to actually show someone what we needed to do. And then finally, I facilitated that implementation. I've been down the path where, you know, I've had certain authority in some of my positions and, you know, bulldozing changes through, as we call it. Hopefully you can understand that.
Yep.
Doesn't necessarily work and it's not sustainable. If you want to make sustainable change in an organization, you have to bring the people along on the journey. You have to facilitate that change, not make the change happen yourself.
Absolutely. And that sustaining piece is critical. And like you need to bring them along. You can push a lot of changes through, but they may not stick. They're not going to be sustainable unless you get them on board.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And you know, I've had experiences where I was thrown in the deep end in one particular role, and these guys are in trouble, literally. They're a production facility. They were not keeping up with their customers. They were causing all sorts of grief in the production process, and I was thrown in, not necessarily as a reliability engineer in this case, but more a production engineer to actually sort out the production issues, but most of them were caused by reliability. You know, I had to facilitate sustainable change to get these guys out of trouble. So, yeah, it was an interesting journey. It was an application of the five habits.
Excellent. So you start the book off with those five don'ts, so people understand what they're not supposed to be doing. And from came the five habits that they need to do to be an extraordinary reliability engineer.
Yes. Yes.
So what are those five habits in order?
Okay. So identifying problems. 2, understanding problems. 3, questioning. 4, decide with data. And 5, facilitate to implement.
Well, that seems simple enough.
It is. So
if it's that simple, why isn't everyone doing it?
Obviously, it's in the application of them. Right. And, you know, there's a whole heap of things in there that can obviously influence this. You know, your superiors can influence this. Your people that you work with can influence this. The people below you, your subordinates, can influence this. The culture of the organization can influence this, and mindsets. I think I go a little bit into that in the book, but not necessarily. Like, it's not a book on culture, for example. I wanted to try and distill the five habits. And, you know, you're up against this stuff, essentially. I've tried to give or illustrate how I've handled it in stories. So you've noticed, you would have noticed that basically every chapter has a story, and that was intentional. And that's what I wanted the book to be, a collection of stories where I've either got it right or wrong, implementing the five habits. So, yeah.
Excellent. So habit 1, we want to identify problems. Mm-hmm. What does that actually mean?
Okay, so it's interesting. As a reliability engineer, and I'm actually on Thursday, I'm speaking in Melbourne about this, and, you know, to a bunch of maintenance managers. The reliability engineer in the Australian context, is to lead the way. And you'll notice Gilbert, the main character in the book, and there's one of the illustrations there where Gilbert's actually leading Jackson, Gertrude, and Paul, they're the different characters in the book, towards a big dollar sign. And this is what Identify does. So the reliability engineer is basically expected, I'm not sure if that's the right word, but part of his job is to actually identify where the big problems are. Okay. And, you know, and he's to lead the way to focus the effort on resolving those problems. So him or her constantly identifies problems, and the maintenance manager basically gets fed that information. Okay, well, not necessarily the maintenance manager; the team gets fed that information. That's better words, and that's what the reliability engineer should do. In my humble opinion, is that he should be constantly identifying problems. There should be always something to work on. Always something to improve.
Absolutely. And if you're identifying those problems proactively, you have time to sort out what the issue is, to do a proper root cause and to implement the right solutions. And you're not just pushed or bulldozing a solution through.
Exactly. But the trick to this whole thing is to bring your, as you just said, don't bulldoze the thing through, but bring the team along on the journey. So going back to that production facility that I mentioned there previously. When I started doing this, I actually went to not the maintenance manager, it was actually the production manager in this case. And I said to this particular guy, there's a piece missing here. We're not identifying problems. Now, this is before the five habits turned up, by the way. We're not identifying problems. We're not improving. And that's why we're having these issues, is that, we're not knocking the things nail on the head. We're doing things reactively. They're running around, something would break and they'd go and fix it. Something else would break and they'd go and fix it. And, you had your people running around all over the show just trying to get the place going. So I stopped and I said, look, I need a little bit of time to do some numbers, i.e. I was about to apply habit four, to do some numbers to help me identify where we should put our efforts. And he said, sure, Seven, how long? And I said, mate, if I haven't got this done in a couple of hours, I said, I'm not worth my money. He says, go for it. So at the time I was using Microsoft Excel. I'm trying to avoid the technical things, but I was using Microsoft Excel. I just got into the shift supervisor log, and I think you're going to ask me some questions about data and what to do without data. And anyway, the shift supervisor log is not accurate per se, but it certainly gave us direction on where we should focus our efforts. And so I just dived in the shift supervisor's log, fixed up all the problems so that Excel would actually work, and then started smashing out some Paretos, and identifying clearly which machine was causing us the issues. And I even gave some little bit of insight of which areas we should focus on. And also, as a part of that, and I talk about this in the book, I also did a little bit of trending, so to see whether the issue was acute or chronic. We had chronic issues in a certain area on this one particular machine that popped out. So much so, the amount of downtime on this particular machine exceeded the time allocated to maintain the whole plant. Okay? So these guys basically had one day per week that they would shut the whole plant down to allow maintenance. So outside of that one day per week, this one machine caused more downtime than one day per week. In a breakdown sense. So we saw that, and we saw that when we trended the data, it was chronic. It was a chronic issue. It was constantly causing us problems. This particular area of the machine was constantly causing us problems. So we got the team together, and, the big boss was there, some of the shifts, the supervisors, some of the tradesmen, some of the technical people, the maintenance manager, the maintenance planner, all I just invited them into this room and said, hey, guys, I've gone through the shift supervisor report and look what I found. And they went, oh, bugger. I said, well, we've got to work on this particular machine. And I said, yes, we are, and this is what we're going to do about it. And then we flicked into habit two. We started to try and understand why this was occurring. And, obviously, the people that were fixing the machine started coming up with the ideas, and habit two, I'm flicking straight into habit two here, mate.
no problem.
Yeah. We started having some really good conversations where the disconnect from the technical people to the craftsmen naturally started coming together, and they started talking about solutions. And I sort of had to pull them up there a bit, and I said, well, hold on, why is that? Why are you suggesting that particular solution? I tried to crack them into the five whys, because these guys weren't really RCA trained or haven't really applied it. We had a sort of informal five whys sort of conversation. And then next thing you've got the craftsmen and the technical people agreeing that's the way that we should go. And lo and behold, I think it was 2 to 3 weeks after we started this process, we started seeing change. The trends on this machine, the downtime trends on this particular machine, started going down. And the manager turned up and said, right, he's looking at the numbers, Habit 4. He says, what are you guys doing? And they just said, oh, well, we just, you know, we just changed this. We just put a bigger thing here. And instead of on our down days, instead of, you know, focusing on less or minor machines, we're focusing a bit of effort on this one. And, you know, we've changed this and we've changed this. And he says, awesome. And cut a long story short, after a while, I ended up was charged with rejigging the whole maintenance strategy because we ended up running out of room to put the stock. They started producing too much. So that's you know, that's what happened. That's the power of Habit 1. You know, if you can get use a little bit of Habit 4, decide with data, present it in a way that engages people, they will start to automatically flick into Habit 2. And a little bit of Habit 5 because they start talking.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
This podcast is brought to you by Iridicio. Be sure to check out Iridicio's IBL blended learning for maintenance and reliability professionals. This SMRP accredited project-based curriculum will take you through all aspects of a maintenance and reliability program and provides you with all the tools you need to generate a 30 times return on investment for your organization and a set of credentials from the University of Tennessee for you. You can find out more at ibltraining.com.
Now, we didn't touch on Habit 3.
Mm-hmm. Habit 3 is question. So, as I said, this one has caused me some grief over the years where I didn't question something, okay, where I basically lived with the status quo. And people probably say, oh, you don't do that because that means you're not making change. And that's exactly right. And you know, obviously we're all about in reliability engineering space is obviously making change for the better, whatever that means. And these one story comes to mind and it was a story where I was in a position of leadership, okay, in this particular story. And I was working with a good friend of mine, known him for years, and we had a big problem. And this problem kept on reoccurring, and we were blowing money like left, right, and center. It was costing us heaps to fix these particular machines, and there was two of them. And when I was maintenance manager, both of them stopped at the same time for exactly the same reason, okay? And this is the first time this has happened, if I recall correctly. And we're in trouble. We're in trouble. We're getting CEO attention.
You don't want
basically. No, we had a whole basic production plant stopped, broken due to exactly the same reason. And the irony of this whole situation was that it's happened before and it's happened multiple times. So here I am in this position of leadership, not necessarily a reliability engineer, more a maintenance manager type person. And talking to my good friend, I said, what are we going to do about it? We've got both of them down. And he says, well, we've got to fix it. And I said, yeah, I know we've got to fix it. But how many times has this occurred? And he rattled off how many times it occurred. And I said, well, we can't just do what we did the last time. And he says, what do you mean? And I said, there's something here that we're missing. Oh, we're not missing anything. We have checked everything. And I said, are you sure? And he says, yes, I'm sure. And I said, look, I'm going to make some phone calls. And I think I mentioned about being involved in an industrial group. And down here in Australia, there's an organization called the Strategic Industrial Research Foundation, SIRF, as we know it. And they run a thing called the Industrial Maintenance Roundtable. And I think in the state or in the Americas, Reliability Web is loosely roughly the equivalent of SIRF down here. So I started making some phone calls to my friends in SIRF. One particular guy, and I talk about this smooth, clean, cool, dry, not overloaded, and correctly looped, Mr. Bissett. So we have a chat to a guy that professes to Mr. Bissett's way of doing things, and he says, Seven, you've got to make sure that this thing is actually running smooth, clean, cool, and dry, not overloaded, and correctly looped. And I said, okay. And I said, well, it's basically a static machine. We can't overload it. And he says, you sure? And I said, right. And so he was questioning me and he says, you sure? And I said, yeah, I think so. And he says, well, has anyone checked the alignment? And I said, no, I don't think so. And he says, Seven, that's one of the first things you should check on this machine. I said, okay. So I went to my good mate and I said, have we ever checked the alignment on this machine? Oh, Seven, he says, oh, Seven, you don't want to go there. And I said, why not? And he says, we've got to pull the whole thing apart. Okay. And what's wrong with that? Well, you don't want to go there. You're going to blow the job out. We won't get the machine going in time. And I said, right. But if we put it back together and it shakes itself in another few months, which it has been doing, we're no further ahead. And I said, to align this thing, I'm sure we don't have to pull it apart. Can't we use lasers? You know, we can get lasers to go around corners these days. And he said, no. We'll check the manual. Okay, I'll go check the manual. So I checked the manual, and fair enough, they said that you have to pull the whole machine apart to align it. And you use a really old technology, namely piano wire. And I looked at the photographs of these guys when they originally, aligned the machine. And they're using piano wire and people on ladders and all sorts of crazy, crazy stuff that, these days you use lasers. And I said to my mate, I think we can actually do this without pulling the machine apart. And he says, really? And I said, look, I'm just going to make some phone calls and clarify this. And he said, okay, all right, Seven, it's your time, mate. I'm going to go over here and start fixing this thing. And I said, okay, you handle the fixing bit. I'll do a little bit of research for a while. Is that okay? Yeah, sure. So I made some phone calls and, lo and behold, cut a long story short, you can get lasers to go around corners and you don't need to pull the machine apart to actually align it.
Hmm.
And then when the guy came to actually check the alignment was that bad. The OEM basically had some very stern words to us, expletives removed. You shouldn't run your machine like this, and no wonder it kept on breaking. So, yeah, and that was a really, really big lesson for me. And then the particular gentleman is a good friend of mine, and I questioned what we're doing. We questioned the actual operating manual or the maintenance manual, operation and maintenance manual of the machine, and we applied something that hadn't been done before in the organization's history. And it worked.
Well, that's all you had to do is question. Mm. Did we look at the...
Yeah, all I had to do is question.
Those things.
Yeah, yeah. And it was probably last year. So this actual story was probably 10 or more. Was it 10 or more years ago? Yeah, about 10 or more years ago. And I talked to I caught up with him. He was the mechanical team leader at the time of the Craftsman. And he said to that date, the machine has not stopped in that way 10 years later.
Well,
after we did that work. So
it was worth the time spent.
Yeah. And, and having some people, an industrial group to lever off. And, I'm a very big fan of, asking questions of others out there to help you basically or achieve your whatever you're trying to achieve, because, there's someone out there that's probably had the problem and can give you some insight in how to solve it yourself.
Yes, absolutely. Mm. Industry groups, resources, people you meet at conferences, those are all great resources you can leverage to get some information on, get some insight from to deal with these sorts of issues.
Yeah. And it was a bad time. It was a really, really bad time. I had the CEO turned up. And he was there for another reason, and I said, Mr. CEO, would you be interested in going seeing some very broken machines? And he said, Seven, he said, no, mate, I trust that you've got this in hand. And I went, oh, Bugger. All right. Thanks, mate. He says, I look forward to some good news from you. Bugger. All right. Nothing to be under pressure.
No, but it sounds like it worked out. So
It did.
So we talked about these five habits. How does one go about implementing these five habits as a reliability engineer?
Okay. If you want to start from the start, I actually would increase your data skills first. So habit four. Okay, so if you're not really good, and I've seen some people like this over my career where they can't turn around an analysis, and this is probably the most techie part of this whole thing. If you can't turn around an analysis, like I used to say, if I can't get some numbers out of this system within 15 minutes, I'm not doing my job. I'm not worth it. Okay, and I stick by that. If someone comes to you and says, hey, I think we've got a problem here, Seven, and if you can't sort of give some insight into yes or no, that is an actual problem within 15 minutes, I think there's some problems there. So if you wanted to start from the start, in my opinion, have some data analysis skills up your sleeve, habit four, okay? That will obviously lead you to be able to turn around, have like questions really, really quickly, but that also gives you the ability to start with habit one. Okay, so if you've already got data skills and can analyze data and present it nicely in a visual format that's simple and easy to understand, start with habit one. Start identifying problems and showing people, hey, I've done some analysis here, right? Look what I found. Get those conversations started, and I can almost guarantee you that you'll start flicking into habit two. Because people want to understand, they start actually naturally asking why. Once they see it, why is that occurring? Okay. And then the challenge is to lead with habit three. And I just used the word lead there. Habit three, and throw some questions in. And if you've got to use habit four, again, okay, decide with some data. You know, get a business case out there, for example, if you've got to use habit four. You know, obviously managers want to see the money, show them the money. And if you've got to do a little bit of habit four and analyze some data a little bit further to show return on investment, use habit four. When everyone agrees, okay, they can see the value of what you've done because, you know, you've had that conversation, you've had a data-driven debate, habit four. Go with habit five and facilitate the implementation. Use whatever skills, powers, influence you have in your organization to make sure it happens, and make sure it happens in good time by facilitating the implementation. Provide the resources to the people. Don't necessarily do it yourself. You know, for example, it could be easier just to take a bucket of money and get some contractors to actually implement the stuff without involving your own people. I'd shy away from that. You know, contractors have their place when it's, you know, obviously specialist knowledge and you don't have that knowledge internally. But if you, you know, you need your people actually doing the implementation. You need your people fitting it in into their normal everyday work. And a bit of a fan of Ron Moore, and he talks about the bow wave, creating the bow wave. I couldn't agree more. Find up to you as a reliability engineer, work with the supervisors, the trades, or the craftsmen, sorry, to find that little bit of time to make that investment, to make that small change that makes that difference to give you some more time. So work with them, not against them. Certainly don't implement things by, for example, using a contractor and just getting it done as quickly as possible without involving your people. I don't believe in that, especially if you want sustainable change.
Yes, absolutely. We talked about, you know, bulldozing those through. Contractors will bulldoze it through, get it done, but it won't be sustainable.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. And you'll find yourself, if you keep doing the same thing, you know, it's only a matter of time before you end up where you were before in the next place, if you know what I mean. You know, if you don't make that sustainable change, habit five, you don't facilitate that change, you'll end up where you were back in the crap again. if you haven't locked it in and you haven't got that knowledge out there in the workplace of why you do stuff, and if people don't understand why you're doing stuff, i.e. they haven't been involved in the change, they'll just go back to what they believe is right. And lo and behold, what they believe is right is wrong. And stuff goes to poo again.
Yep, absolutely.
Mm.
Well, Seven, we talked about these great five habits of an extraordinary reliability engineer. And we got a taste of them. We got a taste of identifying problems, understanding, questioning, data-driven decision-making, and, you know, facilitate to implement. I think we need to dive deeper into each one of these. Would you be open to diving into each one of these in more detail at another time?
Absolutely. Absolutely, mate. Love to.
Perfect. So before we dive into those, though, what I want to do is, where can people find out more about you? Where can they find your book? Where can they see what you're up to at the moment? Where can they reach out to you at?
Okay. There's a few locations that you can do that. First one is reliabilityextranet.com. Okay. So if in doubt, go to reliabilityextranet.com. On there is a blog. And basically what I try to do with that blog is what's going on in Reliability Extranet world ends up on that blog. So there's going to be a few new things come out. So keep your eye on reliabilityextranet.com. If you would like to register with us, we send out email updates of stuff that's going on, including special offers, which is going to be a few. So that's keep that under your hat. So reliabilityextranet.com. You will find you're able to purchase the book there at reliabilityextranet.com, and every book that is purchased through Reliability Extranet, I actually personally sign. So since we released the book earlier in the year, there's now over 500 hard copies in circulation around the world. So that's a lot of signatures. You can also purchase the book via Amazon. And it was a couple of weekends ago now, we did a little bit of promotion to help with International Literacy Day and our partnership with B1G1, where we reduced the price of the book on Amazon and provided some impact to the world. So you can also purchase the book through Amazon.com and LinkedIn. LinkedIn is... I'm also on Twitter, but primarily LinkedIn is the primary focus where I publish stuff on there. People do mostly engage me through LinkedIn. So I'll shoot you a link to my LinkedIn profile as well as a few other links there on Reliability Extranet.
Excellent. We'll make sure to include those in the show notes so people can click on them easily to be taken to the book, your website, your LinkedIn page, whatever the case is, so they can get in touch and talk more about these five habits of an extraordinary reliability engineer with you.
Awesome, mate. Awesome.
Well, Peter, I know it's early in the morning for you, so I want to thank you for getting up early to talk to us about this book and these five habits. I think if people pick up this book, they'll be impacted by it because it's simple, it's straightforward, and there's practical tools and examples of it in the book. So very good job on the book.
Thank you.
So hopefully we can get
it. It's been about a year and 3 months in the making. That's how long it actually took me to get the book from the start of, you know, starting to type things on my computer to when the print proof, which I've got in my hand, actually turned up. It was a year and 3 months.
Well, I think it was well worth the wait because you did a great job.
Thanks, mate. We very much appreciate it.
Well, thanks again, Peter, for taking the time today, and you have yourself a great day.
No worries. Thank you.
I would like to thank you for listening and remind you that you can always find out more on maintenance, reliability, and asset management at www.iridicio.com and by following our blog. The Rooted in Reliability podcast is a proud member of the reliability.fm network. I'd like to ask you to please rate and review this podcast on iTunes or Stitcher. It ensures the podcast stays relevant and is easy to find by like-minded professionals. It is only with your ratings and reviews that the Rooted in Reliability podcast can continue to grow. I thank you for providing this small but critical support. We'll see you next week when we dive into another burning topic with Rooted in Reliability, your plant performance podcast.